Welcome to the BBC Music Magazine podcast and to our thousands of listeners around the world. I'm Jeremy Pound, the magazine's deputy editor, and with me in the studio today are managing editor Rebecca Franks and reviews editor Michael Beek.
Hello.
Hello.
So today it's the turn of the January issue, January 2020, that is, of course. As usual, the issue is packed with features, news, interviews, and over 100 reviews. So anyway, without further ado, let's get on with the show.
Music.
Well, as ever, it's been a busy month in the classical music world, isn't it always? And we've all brought along just one news story each that's recently caught our eye, but you'll find plenty more in our January issue. So we're going to start off with you, Michael. What's been catching your eye in the news?
Well, what's caught my eye and my ears were the Royal Philharmonic Society Awards, which took place a few weeks ago. We were in attendance. Did we enjoy it, everyone?
Absolutely. Yeah,
very much good so. Evening, I thought.
Absolutely, me too. And as usual, it was a real highlight of the classical calendar, and they bestowed 12 awards. Top of the list was their gold medal winner. It was the Russian composer Sofia Gubaidulina, who was in attendance. Other awards went to Shineke for the new Game Changer Award for the work that they're doing. Tansy Davis won the Chamber Scale Composition Award, and Rebecca Saunders won a Composition Award for Large Scale Composition. So that was two great wins. The Ensemble Award went to Aurora Orchestra, who have been doing wonderful things in concert in recent years and various programs for, you know, growing audiences and alike. It was a very, very jolly evening, and it was a great, great lineup of winners. We sponsored the Conductor Award, and that went to the brilliant Mirga Grzegorzewicz-Tyla of the CBSO.
Yes, it was a very vibrant awards ceremony this year, I'd say. I've been going to the ceremony now for 15 years. And I have to say, when I first started going, it was actually as dull as ditch water. It was not it wasn't something you kind of look forward to in the calendar particularly, whereas they've really kind of picked up in recent years. And this year, I think, was the best of the lot.
I really enjoyed the performances as they had as well. They had three performers there. They had a brass quartet playing some Mendelssohn very nimbly. And they had the Hermes Ensemble doing Meredith Monk. And actually, I thought that was interesting because they were nominated, but they didn't actually win. And I really liked the fact that they celebrated all the people who'd been shortlisted as well, because actually that's such a huge achievement in itself. So I really liked that sort of inclusive feel that they had created. And then we had some Haydn from the Castalian String Quartet as well.
I loved that.
They were great. And I actually heard them a few years ago in Banff in Canada in a string quartet competition, and they came second or third, I can't quite remember now, but it was really lovely to hear them again sort of a bit further along on their path. Mm.
With all the winners this year, you really felt that there was this feeling that they all had something new to offer, that there was kind of, they're taking classical music places. They weren't just being honoured because they'd been there and someone wanted to give them a prize. You actually felt that there was a real purpose to the ceremony, I felt.
Definitely. And I was sat next to two members of the Castalian Quartet, and they were genuinely shocked that they won. They were so happy.
Were they?
Really surprised. So it's great that you really don't know until they sort of open the envelope, as it were.
And just as a follow-up, we've had some other awards announcements for the, well, it used to be called the British Composer Awards, but now the Ivor Composers Awards. And we'll be reporting on that in the February issue. But just a couple that caught my eye. Lifetime Achievement Award went to the composer Erica Fox, who we interviewed a few issues ago. A disc of her music's come out on NMC. And she's someone who's not really been in the spotlight and is now getting a chance a bit later in her life to really be in the spotlight.
Nice.
Anna Meredith won the Innovation Award, and Gavin Higgins won the Orchestral Award for The Book of Miracles, which was a trombone concerto.
Excellent. Well, briefly going back to the RPS Awards, I'm sure that someone who must have won an RPS Award of some sort in the past was the conductor Maris Janssens. Now, my news story, sadly, is, of course, he recently died at the age of 76, and the world lost one of his most adored conductors, I think it's fair to say. He was well known for, above all, Mahler, Tchaikovsky, Richard Strauss. Those were kind of certainly my favourites of his sort of recordings and his performances, which I remember most. But he did a lot more than that, and he was very, very popular. His first major post was principal conductor of the Oslo Philharmonic. And he did similarly to what Simon Rattle did with the CBSO, is that he kind of really brought them into the spotlight, improved standards beyond all measure, and kind of gave Norway a, an orchestra to be really proud of. And then, of course, he moved on from there to other posts, including the Concertgebouw and also the Bayerischer Rundfunks in Germany, which is the orchestra he was still with when he died. He'll be much missed.
I remember the first time I heard him. I was actually, it was when I was at university and I worked for a summer as a steward at the Proms, which is great job to do. Definitely recommend it. You hear so much fantastic music. And he conducted Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 4 with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. And it was just the way he kind of whipped up the finale and the excitement that he created was just incredible. Really, really electrifying.
Absolutely. And what a recorded legacy as well. Endless recordings, you know, coming to into the office as well for review. And
I think that's what Rebecca says kind of really puts it nicely, because although you do associate him with good taste and sort of immaculately observed performances, his capacity for excitement was like nothing else, kind of really building up the attention. Actually, we're going to hear in just a couple of minutes. I just want to relate my most strange incident with Marius Janssens. It was a phone interview of all things. And it was when we were doing a piece about Mahler, and I had a booked phone interview with him, which I was doing from home. And I hadn't realised that for some reason our old landline at our old house wouldn't allow calls to Russia, and he lived in St. Petersburg. So I had to interview him on my mobile phone, but the only place I could get a decent reception on mobile phone was at the end of the garden, and it was pouring down with rain. And so I stood at the end of our garden in the rain talking about Mahler 2 with the Russian conductor. I got some very strange looks from our neighbours.
Did you tell him, or did you maintain professional?
I made professional contact throughout.
So you know, built a shed at the end of the garden just in case that happens again.
Exactly. Now, anyway, I was mentioning my favourite. Do you have a favourite recording, by the way?
Well, I think, I mean, there are so many to choose from. I mean, any Tchaikovsky, and I actually did really love, there was an opera recording of Queen of Spades with the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra a few years ago, which I really loved. But really any of the big kind of symphonic repertoire.
Definitely. Michael? I'd definitely go for Mahler, probably number two with the Bavarian.
Yeah. Yes, for me, a real favourite was he did a Mahler 1. It was a live performance with the Concertgebouw back in, I think it was about 2007, 2008, which was absolutely stunning. I still play very regularly today. However, the track I'm going to play now very briefly is it's the bit of the final movement of Mahler's Third Symphony, which he actually recorded this with the Oslo Philharmonic a while back, but it's actually just been released on disc by the C-Max label. And I thought this magnificent end to this wonderful symphony is kind of a good way to say farewell to Marius in general. So there we go. That was the late, great Marius Janssens. But sadly, he wasn't the only major conducting name to have died last month. Rebecca, tell us a little bit more about another.
Yes, we're very sad to say farewell to Sir Stephen Clearbury, he'd been at King's College, Cambridge, directing the choir there for a good number of decades. And sadly, he recently passed away. On a personal note, I actually studied at King's. And so, and he taught me in the first year. We taught counterpoint. We learned how to write in the Palestrina style and studied fugues. And he was always a very, very measured, very calm, very precise. When you were going in there sort of flapping, thinking, I don't know how to write this fugue, he would always be able to bring clarity to the situation in this incredible way. And really, as well, the work that he was doing with the choir, sort of hard to fathom, really, that you can really take it for granted the amount of work that goes into keeping a choir like that, singing, you know, however many services, pretty much every day of the week apart from a Monday. And you know, they would come in with the choir, with the new choral scholars and the choristers at the beginning of the year, and it might sound a particular way, and by the end of the year, it would probably sound like a completely different choir. And he had this real ability to get everybody singing together and to keep them maintained really high standards. So very sorry to hear this news.
Definitely, and really sad after we've been celebrating the 100 years of Nine Lessons and Carols at the end of last year and then his retirement and so soon afterwards.
Mm. And one thing which I think links both Maris Janssens and Stephen Clearbury is that both of them were both absolute gentlemen with the press. They were all, whenever you interviewed them, they would give their time willingly. They would actually listen to the questions you're asking and do their best to answer them as fully as they could.
That's very
true. Pair of absolute gents.
Yeah.
Right. So on to slightly cheerier things. Rebecca, tell us about a first.
So I have brought news of the first full-length main stage work by a woman in to be performed at the Vienna State Opera in its 150-year history. And it has just had its premiere. It was by the composer Olga Neuwirth, and the opera was called Orlando, and it was based on Virginia Woolf's novel of the same name, written in 1928. Which is this remarkable book which sort of time travels, and its protagonist starts off as a man and then becomes a woman, and it takes it right through from Elizabethan England up into the 1920s. And according to Fiona Maddox for The Observer, who went over to see the premiere, she said, yes, there were a few walkouts, but a solid 10 minutes of cheering at the end. Seems like it has gone very successfully, great, really well. And it sounded like a completely fascinating work, actually, really making the most of that time travel to be able to kind of draw on musical influences throughout the ages in an interesting way. And actually taking it forward, I think it takes it right up to the present day. So sort of diverges a bit from the book. But yeah, sounds like a really interesting moment, landmark moment.
Did Fiona elaborate at all on what the walkouts were about? Just because it was atonal or...?
She just says there's a predictable handful of booers. So right. I don't know whether that's just... She says the capacity audience engaged attentively. So it sounds like, for the most part, yeah, most part positive, maybe with just a few discontented people.
And more importantly, is there any news of further productions by women composers in the pipeline in Vienna, or are we going to have to wait a little longer for that?
Yeah, I don't know whether we're going to have to wait another 150 years
well,
or not.
Not.
I mean, potentially. I mean, hopefully we're in a different era. But when Ethel Smyth's Der Wald was performed at the New York Metropolitan Opera in 1903, it's taken until very recent times for the second opera by a woman composer to be performed there, which was Caius Ariajo's La Mort de Loin. So who knows?
We'll just have to see, won't we?
Absolutely.
Let's move on then to this month's magazine.
This month's magazine.
Before we start talking about the January issue, let's have a little reminder to not forget our website at classical-music.com, where you can read all about the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews, and a good deal more. Plus, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and we have an iPad edition available on the App Store. And if you fancy subscribing to our print edition, we have a special discount for our wonderful podcast listeners. All of you can now get 30% off every 6 issues, which takes the cost to just £25.15. You can claim the offer by visiting buysubscriptions.com/musicpodcast. Right, let's get on to what's in the January issue. So let's start off right at the very front of the magazine with a little clip from this month's cover CD. So, Rebecca, what was that on our cover CD?
That was the Allegro from Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 23 in A major, K488. And that was played by soloist Elizabeth Brous with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and conductor Holly Matheson. And that kicks off our cover CD this month, which actually features several of the BBC Radio 3 New Generation artists, which it's their 20th anniversary celebration this year. So we have a really lovely disc of Mozart and Schubert to mark that occasion. And yes, that's free with this month's magazine.
Excellent. And who else is on the front cover this month?
Well, we have a violinist who I think people will recognise, Nicola Benedetti. And we have this fantastic feature, an interview by Richard Morrison. And so the violinist, very much still following her sort of starry career as a high-profile soloist, playing brilliantly in a lot of the world's concert halls. But she also has this other, I don't know how she has time in the day, to be honest, but she has this incredible project which she is really kicking off this year. She has launched the Benedetti Foundation, which is an educational initiative, and it's going to have 6 weekend sessions across the country next year in 2020, and it's sort of been road tested a bit in 2019. She's really passionate about the power of music, in the importance of having it in people's lives, especially in children's lives. And really, that's what she spends the piece talking about.
And it's great that, you know, she's actually doing something. And, you know, lots of musicians sort of talk the talk, but not many sort of have the time, maybe, or have the sort of, you know, inclination to actually do something with it. And she's really, you know, going great guns with this.
What I think is actually really interesting in the piece is that despite the fact she's doing all this outreach work and kind of investing so much of her time in it, she makes it very clear that that doesn't mean she's stopped as a concert violinist. And she runs down the various concertos she's playing within the space of a couple of months. How on earth, where does she get the energy from? It's sort of, it's very impressive.
I don't think she can sleep.
When you factor in all the travelling as well, it's just extraordinary.
So. Yeah. And also I thought it was so interesting. So she's 32 now, but she says that this is something that she really has been thinking about and mulling over and has been very important to her since she was a teenager, actually. And I mean, it was kind of interesting because she won BBC Young Musician of the Year, but then actually she did take a bit of time to do, she always wants to do things sort of on her own terms, yes, and to have thought about them, to be doing them the right way or the way that she believes in. And so I thought that was kind of a very interesting thread that sort of ran through the piece as well.
Mm. It'll be fascinating to see which way or how her foundation goes and the sort of progress it makes. Because as we kind of point out in as a little sidebar to this feature, we give examples of other organisations which have been there to kind of help young musicians. And most of them are doing pretty good things, and very few of them kind of disappear without trace. So there is good hope here.
And obviously the need as well. I think there was recent research by the BPI which showed that music education provision in state schools is down 21% over the last 5 years. So that's, you know, that's quite a pressing need if, you know, we want to still have music and at the heart of education.
Yeah, but it's a shame that these have to plug those sorts of gaps, isn't it? And you want these things to kind of be in addition to, not sort of plugging the gap from what should be there already in the curriculum. But it's great that she's doing it. Mm.
Yeah. And also, I think a big part of it, and perhaps for some of the other foundations as well, is finding the other great communicators, the great teachers, the people who are going to really inspire, and helping them in a way to be even more empowered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my son's recent school concert, the staff room gave a performance. That was the staff room choir.
Oh,
and
it's
brilliant. And the headmaster was there. And I think he was completely out of his comfort zone, but he was adamant that he was going to be taking part, you know, just to lead from the front. And that was, you know, so inspiring.
Mm. More music for all.
Absolutely.
Talking of which, let's have a really rather good recording. Michael, tell me about it.
So our recording of the month for the January issue is an epic recording of Handel's Samson. And this is coming to us from John Button, a Dunedin consort. But not only them, it's a whole host of brilliant soloists like Joshua Ellicott, Hugo Hymas, Jess Dandy, Matthew Brook, Mary and Sophie Bevan, Fleur Wynne, massive cast, actually. And what he's doing with this and what they're doing is trying to show the range of choirs that there might have been in the 18th century. So this may not be how it was originally envisaged, or it might be. They're not really sure. So what they've done is they've recorded it twice. So the CD version, which we review here, is the version of full chorus and soloists. But they've also recorded it with one to a part chorus as well, which you can get as a download in addition. So you can hear both sides of that sort of argument, which is kind of fascinating.
Let's hear a little bit of it then.
Let's hear a bit now.
Oh.
Well, there we are. That was Joshua Ellicott singing the air Total Eclipse from Handel's Samson, which is out on Lynn Records. It's John Butt and the Dunedin Consort.
Right, so we've covered the front of the magazine, and then you find the reviews kind of nearer the back. And then in the middle, somewhere in between them, is a feature we've put together about different types of conductors. Now, we're all fanatics of the concert hall here. And one of the kind of things which I always enjoy when I go to a concert is actually just looking at the conductor and admiring or not so their different styles. But of course, what's fascinating about the conductors is how their roles have changed over the year and how their personas have changed. And so although this is a sort of fairly light-hearted look at 15 categories of conductor, it also traces in a way how the persona of the conductor has changed from the fiery types of the past, who wouldn't be able to get away with that these days, these sort of control freaks and these nutters who would hire and fire at will. Then you have the more genteel types, the gentle ones. These days, we have the communicators. We have considerably more women on the podium these days as well. And it's so we've taken each category in turn. So, for instance, we've labelled them as the tyrants, singers, dancers, non-movers, those who are kind of stock still on the podium, and taking a look at them, different types.
It's great fun. I love that as well. Like, you know, when you're watching a live performance, just it makes, you know, it can make such a big difference to really your impression of the performance, actually. That visual element, and I find that fascinating.
What I think is really fascinating here is that is some of these kind of names are from long, long time ago, so sort of you have to rely on just hearsay from people who've actually seen them to hear about some of these character traits. But there's actually quite good documented evidence in terms of recordings and things like that. So, for instance, Toscanini, who is famous for his appalling temper, there are actually one or two recordings of him just losing it in rehearsal. And you can hear him just go ballistic. There's some lovely footage as well by Adrian Bolt on TV. And of course, although he was sort of in his heyday right at the beginning of the 20th century, he'd lived a great old age until he was 1983. And so he was giving interviews in the sort of 70s and 80s, remembering some of these great names of yesteryear. And that's fascinating. You can find it on YouTube, et cetera. And it's sort of a real insight to how the art of conducting has changed over the years.
Definitely. And I often wonder why people choose to sit in the sort of the choir stalls behind the orchestra. But actually, it would give you a great sort of view of the conductor's face and expressions, all those things. Whereas if you're behind them, you might see their arms flailing and maybe some funny movements, but you don't get to see the face. So maybe I'll sit there at some point.
I think one thing which really tells you, though, is that there's more than one way to skin a cat, as it were, is that so many conductors had got brilliant results in so many different ways. I mean, Toscanini and Reiner scared the life out of their musicians, whereas Barbarolli and Pierre Monteur were absolutely lovely to them. All great conductors. So you don't have to do it one way. Mm.
And even conductors that, you know, might have had what you might call an unorthodox technique. You know, you watch them and they might be really dancing around or jumping or hardly making any movements. And you think, well, how on earth can the musicians be picking up anything from them? But actually, sometimes the most unorthodox techniques are the most interesting, really.
Definitely.
What I don't buy into is this kind of, you often hear this comment that all conductors are less characterful these days than they used to be. I don't think that's true.
I really don't. And I think you as well, like, the more you go to concerts, the more you think, well, that has a huge impact, really. And there's such a variety of styles and approaches and sounds that I don't buy that argument.
There might be different types of character these days than there used to be, but I don't think they're characterless. Mm. So let's hear what conductors can do by moving on to our first listen section. Before we kick off with sharing our favourite new recordings, we'd like to tell you about how you can get involved in sharing your musical discoveries with us and fellow readers. That can all be done by going to our Facebook page, where you'll find an area called The Listening Room, where we like to share ideas. We'll pitch in with our own ideas, readers do as well, and it's a very good conversation. We enjoy going there and hope to see you there as well. Plus, you can hear our choice of the latest recordings on our Apple Music Playlist Curator page. Once you're there, just look for The Playlist. It's that simple. And don't forget, if you send us what you've been listening to at music@classical-music.com, you could be in with a chance of being published on our Music to My Ears page in the magazine itself. Hurrah! So, what have we been listening to? Well, we're talking about conductors just now. So, well, I'm going to start off by recording by one of my favourite current conductors, and that is the American Joanne Folletta. Her recording is called Forgotten Treasures, and in it she conducts the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. And before I tell you what it is, I'm going to play a little bit of it for you. Before I tell you what that was, I'm going to do a bit of a blind listening test here. Which composer do you think that was there?
I'm going to say Dvorak.
Well, my money is on Brahms.
Yes, I can see why you say both of those, because it does sound like those two. It sounds like Dvorak's Slavonic Dances or Brahms's Hungarian Dances.
It does, yeah.
Actually, it's by a composer called Leo Vina, who is Austrian, similar, a little bit later than Brahms and Dvorak, but not that much. Now, this disc is called Forgotten Treasures, and it's composers who'll be, you might know the name pretty well, but probably not much of their music. So we have Schmidt, Vina, Martucci, Pizzetti and Cherepnin, all names you kind of recognise from the catalogue, but possibly don't know the music that well. A lot of it is sort of kind of late romantic stuff. It's beautifully played by the Buffalo Philharmonic. It's from a series of concerts, so it's all live performances. And it's just a nice introduction to kind of four or five composers. Once you hear it, you think, oh, I want to hear a bit more of them. The Vina, as I say, is very, very Brahmsian, very Dvorakian. But the Pizzetti and Martucci reminds me actually a little bit of a sort of kind of Respighi, perhaps. Almost kind of, I don't know if you know, Wolf Ferrari, that sort of late Italian feel. Absolutely gorgeous stuff.
I'm definitely going to be borrowing that. I think that sounds like a great one.
It's a great disc. I really enjoyed it. That was Vina's Hungarian Folk Dance Suite. And that disc, and that was the Presto, which is the final of the four movements. And this disc, by the way, is on Beau Fleuve Records, which sadly I don't think is streamed yet, so you're going to have to buy the hard copy. So, Michael, what about yours?
I've been listening to this fabulous disc called Jupiter, and it's actually the name of the group performing. So this is a super group, if you like, classical musicians, started by the lutenist Thomas Dunford. So the group includes people like the mezzo Lea De Sandra, it includes Bruno Philippe, the cellist, Peter Whelan, bassoonist, Jean Rondeau on harpsichord and organ. It's a proper super group of artists, and it's all Vivaldi, the programme. And we're going to hear a piece from Jupiter Triumphans, which is Amate Face et Angubus. Armate face d'anguibus, acecur regno squallido, acecur regno squallido, furore socce barbari, furie, 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 venite a nos. Armate face d'anguibus, acecur regno squallido, so that's the brilliant Lea De Sandra there singing with the group Jupiter. They all have their moments to shine, but she's an absolute standout on the disc.
I was about to say, is it all that acrobatic?
Not quite, no. It's a mixture of concertos and airs, so you get sort of vocals, but you also get instrumental pieces as well. It's a real, really lovely album.
Excellent. And Rebecca, what have you brought for us?
I bought something a bit different from that. I've bought a disc called The Etudes Project, Volume 1, and that is on Sono Luminous, and it features the pianist Jenny Lynn at the start of a big journey to record a lot of solo piano etudes, which is a form that kind of you can trace through keyboard history, really. And there are famous examples here by Debussy, Scriabin, Rachmaninoff, Messiaen, Ligeti, more recently Philip Glass. But what she has also done is has a whole batch of new etudes by a group of, they're called the Iceberg Composers. And she hasn't really asked them to respond to these sort of more well-known etudes, but just to write their own. And then she's kind of paired them. So the whole disc, it's sort of these little pairings and couplings of etudes in a huge variety of styles. And I've chosen one that is by the American composer Ruth Crawford Seeger, who was alive from 1901 to 1953. And this is the Study in Mixed Accents from 1930, which has been described as a modernistic minute waltz. And I think we're going to hear a clip from that now. So that was the Study in Mixed Accent by Ruth Crawford Seeger, played by Jenny Lynn. And we're just saying it makes you feel a bit seasick, that one, really. But it's great fun, actually. It's just lovely. Great fun to listen to, definitely.
So there you go. There's three bits of listening, which we hope will grab your ears in one way or the other. And I'm afraid to say that brings us to the end of this month's podcast. Our fantastic jingles were composed by Christopher Maxim, and our podcast is produced here in Bristol by the fantastically patient Ben Newitt and Jack Bateman. So it's goodbye from me, Rebecca and Michael. And then there'll be a different lot of the BBC Music Magazine team coming next month to talk about our February issue. See you then. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
The BBC Music Magazine podcast.